This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. As some of you know, our editorial director, Austin Ray, lives in Atlanta, Georgia. So I've had a great reason to spend some time down there over the past few years getting to know the city through his perspective. Its food, music, and of course its beer. Recently, I watched as Austin's life as a beer drinker in the state of Georgia was dramatically changed with the passage of a new law that enables breweries to sell their beer directly to drinkers in their own tap rooms, over their own bars, and out their own doors. For some breweries, it's an opportunity for incremental sales. For others, it's an evolution of their business plan. And for those that are in the process of opening new breweries, it's a chance to introduce entirely new business models for making and selling beer in the state of Georgia. It's been about 6 months since the law has passed, which has given everyone, brewers and drinkers alike, some time to get used to the new normal. And by all accounts, it's been a pretty exciting time, full of new opportunities and some hard lessons. It's also inspiring new thinking about the future. Austin helped me put together a group of folks all with a unique perspective on the state of Georgia beer to talk about their role in the changes and what they're going to do next. My guests in this roundtable are Bob Sandage from Wrecking Bar, a brew pub with his own farm who recently started can sales for the first time ever. Nick Purdy from Wild Heaven Beer, who said he wouldn't have signed the lease for his expansion without the new laws being signed. Brian Purcell of Three Taverns in Decatur, who's now getting lines down the block for new releases and considering an off-site taproom to build the brand. And perhaps most importantly, Nancy Palmer, Executive Director of the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild, who was the most responsible for getting the new legislation enacted on behalf of her constituents, and seems to have not lost a moment working on what's next. This week, Nancy also won the prestigious FX Matt Defense of the Industry Award from the Brewers Association, largely in recognition of those successful efforts. It's a hell of a group to chat about the future of beer with in the great state of Georgia. Listen in. Thanks for joining me. We're here at Three Taverns, and we are going to talk to a panel of four folks in the Atlanta / Decatur beer scene here. You smiled because I gave Decatur some specificity. Yes. Gets lumped in a lot. And I thought this was going to be a great group of people. I'll introduce you each individually so people can hear your voices and kind of associate a little bit with you. So once we get going, people might kind of lose track of who's talking. But we wanted to specifically kind of do a visitation for Atlanta's beer scene in the wake of a big piece of legislation passing that allows taproom sales, basically. So the four people we have here is our host, Brian Purcell from Three Taverns. Brian, go ahead and give us a quick little spiel on Three Taverns.
Three Taverns is a Decatur brewery. We launched close to 5 years ago, really 4.5 years ago, with a focus on Belgian-style beers, or as I would say, open-minded interpretation of traditional Belgian-style beers. We've journeyed a lot since that early beginning, and I think Belgian beers are less than 20% of our portfolio now. So, but we maintain that same...
You just won't let it go.
Won't let it go. Can't. trying to hold on to those deep roots that traveled across the ocean. Yep. So the philosophy that I think the Belgian brewers pioneered many years ago in search of new discoveries. So yep. That continues to define us. We have a very broad range of beers. We like to make everything, but we have a growing staff of about 15 of us now, I think, and that's not including the tasting room staff. So okay. That's Three Taverns.
Great. We've got Bob Sandage from Wrecking Bar, kind of a unique institution here in Atlanta. Tell us about Wrecking Bar.
Sure. Yeah, I sold my engineering company in 2009, bought the property in 2010, and then opened up Father's Day 2011. So we're coming up on our seven-year anniversary in a few months, and it's been quite a journey. Like Brian has said, you know, we've been through, someone who started off the brewery, and then I took over 6 months afterwards and was a brewmaster for a few years, and all the while training a couple other people. And one, Neil Engelman, is now our brewmaster, and he's doing great things for the beer program. And the food was the hardest part. You know, it was, we started off very conservative, very safe. And then, you know, we kind of worked through two or three chefs in the first year, and then about a year and a half in, we got our chef Terry Koval, who's
incredible.
Yeah, and we've really embraced, you know, my business partner Stevens and I bought a farm in Loganville in 2015, so a lot of the produce comes from there, and all the meat, you know, comes from within a couple hours. You know, Riverview Farms, White Oak Pastures.
I was lucky enough to head out to the farm with him right after you guys bought it, and we're starting to talk about what you were going to do. And you had a woman there that was the sort of the head farmer, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It was an incredible opportunity for you guys to integrate that with the operation.
Yeah, it's very, very synergistic.
Awesome. And today, I'm hoping to talk to you about your new package sales, which are newly enabled by some of the laws down here. So I'm excited to talk about that.
Great.
Nick Purdy from Wild Heaven. Wild Heaven beer, not Wild Heaven craft beer.
As we have discussed in detail on long text message chains.
Tell us about Wild Heaven beer.
My partner Eric Johnson, who's our brewmaster, and I started it about a little over 7 years ago. We contract brewed for a while, opened up a facility in 2014 here, kind of also in the Decatur area. Mm-hmm. I like to tell that our brew house is the most historic in Georgia's history, as it was the original brew house for Sweetwater Brewing, bought back in 1997.
All right.
A few years later, it ended up in Athens and made Terrapin beer for a decade till the end of 2013 when we brought it over. So it has made, you know, three well-known beers, Sweetwater 420, Terrapin Rye, and now Emergency Drinking Beer.
No kidding. That's made a lot of people very wealthy.
I'm hoping to join that list one day, but we're not there yet.
And Nancy Palmer from the Guild. Is it the State Guild?
Yes, yeah, so Georgia, it's the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild, and we're the trade association that represents the breweries and brew pubs of the state.
Excellent. I'm going to jump right in with you because you're coming off of a legislation session that just closed.
Yes.
And when you sat down, the conversation immediately began on some of the bills that were popping up that, you know, maybe were or, you know, had the potential to be either opportunistic or damaging to the craft beer, the craft brewers industry here in the state. One of them you mentioned was very significantly associated with retail. And so we started having this conversation immediately, and you were bringing one of your constituents up to speed on it here with Nick. Tell us about just to give people, you know, a sense of how in flux some of this stuff is, give us a sense of what it was that you were talking about there with the retail delivery services that are becoming popular around the country, but they're not able to, you know, operate everywhere and not yet in Georgia.
Yeah, so retail direct-to-consumer sales have gone through changes all over the country, and some of that is direct-to-consumer shipping, and whether that's from a manufacturer direct-to-consumer or from a retailer direct-to-consumer. Or in the case of what we were speaking about earlier, we're talking about on-demand delivery of alcohol products.
So Drizzly's, Caviar, Peapod,
right,
kind of things.
Yeah, Minibar, Saucy. There's about a million of them. But even Postmates, Seamless, they would all be kind of willing to do that. And each one of those companies has a little bit of a different model. But in Georgia, none of them are allowed. And furthermore, even curbside delivery of alcohol is not allowed.
Right.
And so some of the challenges for having those companies come in are regulatory and could be dealt with kind of distinctly at the Department of Revenue without legislative intervention. Other things that these companies might want to do would require legislative intervention. And I think that part of the challenge of kind of the way that our guild looks at it and the way the industry is looking at it, and the broadest sense is one, that were we to have these companies come in to do it in a purposeful way, in a way that where we intend to do it and then it happens, as opposed to some rule gets changed and then the back door and everyone kind of floods into the market using a loophole or something like that. So some of it is wanting there to be an intentionality to it. And do our best to anticipate all of the potential with the potential ways in which it could either be used or abused, depending on your attitude.
It's difficult in a lot of new industries. I mean, any market that somebody like Uber's gone into, it seems like their approach has very much been to try and just break the system rather than work within it, because there's so many things that have to be untangled in order for it to work, you know, with a new kind of technology or a new kind of service that didn't exist before. I would imagine a lot of these delivery services, their biggest burden is the legal environment in every state that they open in.
It absolutely is, and I've been actually very impressed with Drizzly in particular. Their general counsel has been active in speaking to state regulators and having them understand what's going on, why they want to do it, how they do their business, what the options are for any state, and they do want to be compliant. And they are in part owned by WSWA, which is the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers Association. Okay. So the National Trade Association that represents wine and spirits wholesalers does have a stake in Drizly, which is an interesting relationship, but it does mean that Drizly is probably one of our most of the companies that are out there, the most savvy from a regulatory and legal perspective. And so I think that their approach is ultimately going to be successful. But for states like Georgia, depending on the kind of Drizly model that any given retailer would want to use, there's a few different ways that Georgia could modify its laws and regulations in order to allow for something, for a company like that to open here and to be successful. And from our perspective, we just want to make sure that, one, if craft breweries would like to engage in these direct-to-consumer delivery sales, that craft breweries and brew pubs are allowed to do that. And two, that, again, when we do change these rules, that they're done in a way that's mindful, not in a way that's haphazard.
Well, I would imagine mindfulness is, as some of these laws are becoming more modernized, I would imagine that at some point you've done enough historical correction work. And now you start to have to shift towards the future to make sure that these laws are preparing for the option of things going forward. So, it'd be great if, you know, potentially great if something like Drizly or Uber Eats or whatever can start delivering alcohol in Georgia. But you don't want in the future to wish that you had taken part in that in a more significant way and then suddenly find yourself trying to make up for lost time again.
Oh, sure. I mean, we look at farm winery law. If we had been really on top of it in the early 90s, we'd be sitting pretty right now. I think that you're totally right. There's the traditional way that laws change, and you can look to any state that's more advanced than Georgia and see, you know, where the checkbox are. Mm-hmm. But we do have to anticipate internet sales now. We need to anticipate that marketplace. We need to anticipate the direct-to-consumer and on-demand sales and what that looks like. So I think that there's a lot about the craft brewery business model that's going to change across the country. And so we're fighting, you know, the standard old battles, like, you know, do we want to do self-distribution? Do we want to look at franchise reform? And then we also have to simultaneously look at how do we get ready for a world that 25% of alcohol sales are going to happen online? And how are we ready and prepared for that? And how do we make sure that the craft breweries of this state can take advantage of that the minute that it's available?
Mm. Those are a lot of what ifs.
I know. That's my job.
Is self-distribution sort of a priority for brewers here in Georgia for right now? Is anybody here at this table looking forward to the possibility of self-distribution?
If you've gotten your brewery up and running, it's difficult to imagine a scenario in which you even would have a way to go back and do that. That seems to be a thing that, to me, like, if you didn't do that from day one, I'm not sure how you would go back and do it.
Yeah.
So for me, at Wild Heaven, it's not a priority.
Yeah. What about you guys?
Well, being a brew pub is not as critical for us. I mean, we do distribute beer through United, and I think probably where it would help us is for festivals and things that, you know, the distributor really doesn't care about one or two or three kegs. It's kind of more of a bother for them. You know, but I think you know from a brewery perspective, my feeling is that there's some people out there that, you know, maybe, you know, at the best might be in 1,000 barrels, you know, and it's really tough for them to make it when they have to worry about, you know, to make it from the you know, small brewery to the medium sized brewery when, you know, they're at the whim of their wholesaler, you know, and they have to wait, you know, quite a while to get their money, and at least now with the laws changing, they can, you know, generate some revenue in the tap room. But, you know, if they were able to, you know, take, you know, their couple hundred barrels a year they're producing and deliver it themselves. You know, I know other states have some, you know, some provisions for up to, I don't know if it's 25,000 barrels in North Carolina. I don't think it would have to be that much, but, you know, there's some things I think that could be done to help out the smaller breweries, you know, help them get to the point where they could be a medium or large size brewery.
Yeah, let's revisit self-distribution in a minute, because there's a lot of new breweries coming up behind you guys that are probably very keen on that as a business model. But before we do that, I want to talk about what's happened with your business models as a result of the most recent legislative win, which is the ability to sell beer in a tap room, which I think to most people in the country is a default sort of understanding of how breweries even make a living these days. On-premise sales is becoming more and more of a familiar concept to people who are entering craft beer as consumers, and certainly people who are starting breweries are taking advantage of that ability to sell at a much higher retail margin, so they're selling less beer for more, you know, for more margin, and they're able to make it that way. They're not necessarily setting their sights on regional production distributing kind of status. They're staying smaller and more hyper local. What have you seen, Brian, in your percentage of beer going into the market that's happened since that rule change? How much of your beer do you think you're selling through the tap room now that used to be going out into market?
Probably. Well, I can tell you that if I look at September 1st, when the law changed, of 2017 through March 31st of 2018, my beer, retail beer to go sales are now in the previous September of 2016 through March 31st, 2017, we could sell a tour, which included a certain amount of beer to go. And so we were sending beer out the door,
right?
But it was not truly buying beer, and there was a limit, a pretty small limit on what you could take. But I can say that the September through March of this year, over the same period last year, we have grown our to-go sales 450%. So it's been significant for us.
Yeah.
And some of those beers have been beers that you can only get at the brewery. And then other of the beers we sell in distribution already, but now you can pick them up at the brewery. I would say the bulk of that growth has been in beers that are either new launches or beers that are brewery exclusives. And so it's been significant for us.
That's interesting. So it's introduced, you know, so a certain amount of percentage is now being sold directly of beers that were already in the market, which is going to give you higher margin on those same barrels.
Correct.
But now you're also introducing a new idea, which is beers that only get sold at the brewery and never make it to market at all.
That's correct.
How has that changed your life?
it's not where it will be at some point. We're still dealing with a culture, mm-hmm. the Georgia beer culture, which has grown up on buying beer off the shelf in distribution. They don't think of the average Georgia beer buyer doesn't think of coming to a brewery and picking up his beer. So I think what we'll see in the later years as the law becomes more of just what people are used to and expect will be more significant sales out of the brewery.
So are you saying that there's some consumers that feel burdened by having to come get it?
I don't know that it's burden. It's just not how they think about buying beer.
A lot of folks still don't even know they can.
Okay. Yeah.
So
they just haven't come around since that.
No, our brewery tap room line still gets phone calls every weekend asking what time they need to book their tour. So how long it takes people to find out about an entirely new set of rules around an industry that probably most people wouldn't have reason to think about.
Right.
You know, we've seen it picking up. Like it's the growth that we've had month over month, year over year, those growth rates seem to be increasing. And I remember Eric and I were talking to somebody in like North Carolina or South Carolina. I think it was South Carolina who had their laws updated, I guess, a few years before we did. And they said, yeah, it's going to take like 6 months before people even know what the heck you're doing.
Mm.
And that's been reflected for us. Like our January, February, March were just fantastic.
Mm.
So,
I mean, at the same time, I mean, going back to that sort of retail experience, you have people who have traveled for beer outside of the state that are very familiar with this kind of interaction and this kind of engagement. How's it been trying to live up to their expectations of what a beer release is? I mean, you've got people lining up at Wrecking Bar to get cans. You've got people lining up for, you know, special releases at the brewery now. Like, what has it been like trying to meet the expectations? I mean, you guys weren't retailers before. You gave tours, but you weren't really, I mean, you weren't in the retail business. You know, you weren't necessarily managing that experience in such a consistent way. What's it been like since that rule changed for those kind of folks?
Well, I guess I'll say, you know, I can't speak for the breweries, but as a group, we're not really geared for the amount of volume that we're now able to do via, for example, a can release. We had, I think, our fifth one back about a week and a half ago, and we, you know, it took us a whole day to can up, I think it was around 60 cases of beer, so around 1,500 cans, and 90% of those sold in 1 hour on Wednesday night. So we spent, weeks, getting the beer ready, and then, a day or two getting it in the can, and poof, it's all gone in an hour. So
a little anticlimactic for you?
No, actually, it was. We were all very, very happy about how it went, you know, and we're trying to do, you know, I think most of our can release will probably have some, you know, we've already put a rule in place that we won't can any IPA that isn't, you know, IPAs are our best seller and probably a lot of breweries' best sellers, and we won't can anything that's been on tap already. So when it's, you know, hit its time where it's at its peak and it's ready to go on tap in the pub is when we sell the beer in the cans. Hmm. And it's, you know, people know that when they come and get those, it's, you know, canned on probably the day before. And so they're going to get a fresh IPA. Some of the other beers don't, you know, they don't matter, but there's, like, for example, the Jemmy Stout, we can up occasionally, and I've got some at home that's canned 2 or 3 months ago, and it's even better now than it was. But the hoppy beers, you definitely want fresh. And
yeah, was there an assumption for you guys that people might be skeptical of its freshness if it's something that's already been on tap, but now it's in cans? Like, were you trying to make it very obvious that this was a freshly canned beer? Is that what you were concerned about?
Yeah, making it very obvious. And I think, you know, some of my advice is, you know, president of the Craft Brewers Guild is for all the breweries out there, try to, you know, at your breweries, try to put your freshest beer on. Because I've been to some notable breweries in the state where, you know, I figured, oh, hey, I'll be able to get a fresher IPA. And I'm that guy that looks through all the ones at Kroger or the beer store. And I was just there yesterday, and the newest IPA I could find was 4 weeks old. Yeah. And honestly, after 2 or 3 weeks, it's reached its peak, and it's starting to tail off. And, you know, I've had some brewery visits where it's like, oh, I'm going to get a really nice fresh IPA, and it's no newer than what I find. It's 3 or 4 weeks old. So I'd encourage, you know, the because, you know, whether you're a brew pub or brewery or whatever, you know, it's just the dynamics of, you know, the volatility of hops in the package. It's going to, unless you're the big guys like Sierra Nevada or Stone, who somehow seem to, you know, can manage to have 2 months in the can or the bottle and still have some semblance of a hoppy beer, it's a little tougher for the smaller.
Yeah, I mean, we're not even just talking about laws in this case, you know, that dictate what you're able to make. I mean, these laws were holding you back, it sounds like, from even being able to make some of these smaller batches because you want to be able to move through them so quickly. And so these beers weren't even existing. So it's the law changes enabling new beers to exist at a fundamental level. And at that point, we're not just talking about the laws holding things back, but the infrastructure through which beer goes in 2018 is an infrastructure based on, and a logistical system based on, major production breweries from 30, 40, 50 years ago that hasn't really changed all that much. And in order to take part in a much newer, hyper-local kind of idea of what beer making is, required law changes, which enabled you to create a new kind of delivery experience, basically. I think a lot of consumers, in my mind, and even breweries, tend to take it for granted that, like, this is really just about an increased margin of direct-to-consumer, but it's really about the ability to bring new kinds of beers to market in a direct sales system that supports those things even existing in the first place. Because warm shelves at Kroger aren't going to help that beer shine in the end.
Right. Yeah, I think that part of the culture change, that it's very interesting for me as the guild director to see the way that the breweries that have existed and were open 3 years ago, 4 years ago, which is ancient, of course.
Mm-hmm. In beer law time, it is.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And see how they're managing the new laws, and then seeing how breweries that are planning on opening or have opened since September 1st, how they're managing the new laws, and it's totally different. Right, so for breweries that are older, they generally did not go into retail locations. They went into industrial locations. Mm-hmm. And so they already have that challenge of, how do we bring people out to this, you know, $2 a square foot location that we locked into many years ago. I think for it's managing that retail experience, as you pointed out, where all of a sudden, maybe you do want to be open 10 hours a day, and maybe you do need 20 employees to make that happen. And how do you train a consumer to think about a brewery not as a special event location, but as an everyday location? Mm-hmm. As a, you know, here's where I come after work, not just here's where I bring my parents when they're in town.
Right.
So retraining the customer and trying to balance those hours of operation in a way that makes the most sense for you financially, but also makes most sense to the customer. That's, I think, a real challenge for breweries that currently exist. New breweries who are opening with this retail sales in mind, they're the ones that are gonna really maximize what the law can do. And that's because they're going to go into retail locations. They're going to spend a lot of money in their tap room. It's part of their business plan. That retail experience is part of what they're building, and they know it's part of what they're building. And it's something that actually the brew pubs in our organization has been very helpful teaching the breweries in our organization stuff about, like, POS systems, how to keep a tab open. Mm-hmm. You know, just kind of really, like, really basic stuff that our breweries had no idea about. And so it's been a very interesting kind of thing to look at from an overview, the older breweries and the newer breweries and how they're dealing with it. And I do think that some of the newer breweries are going to be training those new consumers that then come back to the older breweries. And we'll see that kind of education spread through newer breweries in a way that's really interesting.
Yeah, I know. That reminds me, Nick, of a quote. I think you were in the press, could have been on Good Beer Hunting, could have been somewhere else, I don't remember, but where you basically said, without this new law, you wouldn't have done your expansion over by Monday night. Yeah. That you were basically waiting for this law to get signed, for that ink to dry, before you started to put that investment in place.
Yeah, we're working on a second brewery location that while it does, Nancy, still have outstanding square footage price, because we're a little bit out on the bleeding edge in terms of which part of town it is on this Beltline. And for those that aren't in Atlanta that don't know what the Beltline is, it's this ring of trails that goes through a bunch of the older neighborhoods in the city and has proven a boon for development. That's where Mitch Steele's New Realm is, mm-hmm. more on the much more populated part of the trail. But yeah, we needed a way to expand, and we would not have thought about doing another brewery location in the same metropolitan area if it weren't for this law that, you know, gave us the opportunity to think really creatively and more like one of those newer breweries that Nancy's thinking about. That second location for us will look and feel a lot more like one of these new breweries that's really thinking it primarily about own premise. I mean, the brew system there is going to be largely devoted to beers that are primarily made just for that location.
How big is it going to be, the brew system?
Well, we're going back and forth, but we're thinking we're going to stick in the 7 to 10 range.
Yeah,
and
that's then small compared to what you've been working with over at the main production facility.
Yeah, and we may have some different pathways that we're looking at for how we're going to really do the scaling part of our business, which is definitely in play. But for that facility, we may end up just focusing a little bit more on really creating that great experience for consumers to come hang out, enjoy, taste something new, take something home.
What do you think when you start thinking about a place that's primarily a retail experience over, you know, and I say primarily because it's not about production levels, you know, 7 to 10 barrel system is much more about a small sort of retail experience. What are some of the biggest, I guess, shifts or flips on the head of how to design that space that you've encountered compared to what you've done before with Wild Hemp?
Well, you know, at breweries of our era, we were founded, like I said, in 2010, opened our main production facility in 2014. We're kind of like in this, three taverns would be the same, Monday night would be the same, kind of in this second era of Georgia craft breweries. We were building production facilities in largely industrial or light industrial areas, and our tap rooms were, oh, and by the way, let's figure out a way to kind of wedge that in. But in terms of, like, our tap room is, like, open to the production space. And frankly, during the week, it largely is production space. And we sort of convert it back and clean it up and tidy the room up a bit when we're about to open. Not every brewery's like that, but that's mm-hmm. sort of how ours set up. And so, yeah, now you think about the tap room more like if you were a bar or restaurant owner. And so you're going to make it beautiful. You're going to make it nice. Our tap room is not a conditioned space in terms of heat. You know, we have heaters, but it's not like air conditioned during the summer.
Right. The expectations overall for hospitality, I mean, other than being personable and accommodating as you can, are pretty low.
They're
People
low.
Expect it to be a kind of raw industrial space, picnic tables,
yep.
concrete floors, simple bar.
And, yeah. and going forward, there'll be some of those elements that still feel like brewery, but I think it's incumbent upon us to think more about that guest experience, more about hospitality, create a space that's beautiful and inspiring. I mean, we've got some really neat art ideas we're working on for our space. So, yeah, we as manufacturers definitely have to shift our mindset and, you know, think more like, what is it like to own and run a restaurant and a bar and
yeah. and a store?
And a store.
I would say I would have definitely thought through the layout of our tap room very differently if I'd known that we were going to be retailing beer at some point, or if I'd been thinking or had a vision for retailing beer, which I didn't. It's been a learning curve. You asked a question earlier how it's been, and we decided on September 1st, where there was such enthusiasm from the Georgia public, or at least the beer drinking public that was paying attention. We knew breweries were going to be packed anyway. So we decided we wanted to add a little extra attention to Three Taverns. We released three new beers on September 1st that you could buy to go. And
you did that. Was that one of the midnight things?
No, it wasn't midnight. Okay. No, that was another brewery up in Kennesaw.
Brian's too old for that.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was sleeping at midnight. So, but the next day when the law changed and we had a special beer that we were releasing. It's called German Chocolate Helm's Deep. It's one of those. It's a 13% super viscous fudgy stout with coconut espresso. It's not a beer that a ton of people had at the time, but we just happened to have poured it at Shelton Fest, which was less than a month before that, and it became one of the surprise hits of the festival. So by the time September 1st rolls around, we have a line that's up the street, and we weren't exactly...
Which is sort of what you wanted.
It's exactly what we wanted, but... our POS system was brand new, first time we'd used it.
Oh, good Lord.
And and it's a wireless system, so the internet overloaded, and we had two lines, one for the bar, one for the beer to go, but they kind of it was a cluster, and we got through it, and we sold a lot of beer, and people were generally enthusiastic and happy, but it could have gone a whole lot better, and it has gone a lot better.
I'd imagine that the ones that are comfortable on the internet were unhappy. That's how that usually goes. I would imagine there was some feedback coming over your Facebook page.
A
little frustrated.
Yes. Oh yeah, there was a couple of people in particular that wanted to make sure they were heard, and they were, loud and clear. But overall, it was a great experience, and most people really enjoyed it.
Yeah, a little bit of trial by fire. Well, I'm curious what you've done. I mean, you listed off a number of things, Nancy, about, that are just first-time things. How to leave a tab open, POS systems, which you just managed, Brian. Like, what were some of the things you immediately went back to the drawing board on to kind of, like, redesign for those kinds of things?
Well, one of the things was how to manage the line. We saw a lot of people were cutting line, and we weren't policing that. We were inside dealing with other things, and we heard a lot of complaints, not toward us necessarily, just toward the entitlement that some people had and the way that they cut line, and some people didn't get their beer, and they knew it was because other people were cutting in lines. So we pretty quickly thought, well, we can't police the line, but what we can do is manage that better. So the next time we did a big release like that, we checked IDs and gave people bracelets as they got into line. So that way, if you cut line, you can't get a bracelet. You're going to have to be behind the last guy that had one. So that helped out a lot, ran a lot smoother.
How'd you come up with ideas like that? Were you just calling up a bunch of breweries outside of Georgia saying, how do you sell beer like this?
We just brainstorming.
Because there's a lot of historical knowledge out there.
There is,
outside the state of Georgia.
Actually, a brainstorming with people that have been to, we invited in a group of people that have been to a lot of beer releases in other states.
Oh, okay.
And we said, how do you see it done?
That's a
in
great
other
idea.
Places, yeah. And so, and there's a lot of beer geeks here in the local community that have traveled for beer for many years. So,
yeah, sure.
They had a lot of...
Expanded the brain trust a little
bit.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Excellent idea. Bob, I know for you it's a little bit of a flip because you guys are that brew pub, that warm hospitality restaurant kind of experience built around beer. For you to open up your doors to, packaged releases is a very sort of... That's a destination brewery thing to do. And so it's kind of a, it's a little bit of a flip of what these guys are describing here. You guys knew how to run hospitality. You knew how to run POS. You knew how to keep tabs open and run a bar and things like that. That's all very, very familiar. What were some of the ahas you had in your first few releases, and how have you gotten better at those?
Yeah, you're right. We did, Brian had set up a kind of a lunch and learn session where we brought in probably 20 or 30 breweries in the city, or maybe even outside of Atlanta too, to talk about how, even things like glassware, but you're right. We had a lot of those procedures already down, but still, we still get overloaded. There's a line that goes down Austin Avenue when we do a can release now, and we haven't really seen people cutting in line, but there are people that that get upset that, you know, they were the one right after the special IPA ran out. And so then it's taking to Yelp and, you know, Untappd and everywhere else where they can voice their opinion. But, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do about that. But it's just, I think, you know.
What's that doing for your parking situation?
Good question. Yeah.
Well, that luckily, was my first thought. I was like, shit, can I park there anymore?
You just can't, right. No.
It's tough. I mean, we do have more parking in Little Five Points area than most people do, but still, we've tried to do our big things like the can releases and you know, like our festivals also that are at less popular times for the restaurant. So, yeah, we've mostly done our can releases on a Friday afternoon. Gets people that want to, you know, quit work a little bit early and come, and it's you know, parking lot is available. There's not shows going on at the Variety or Horizon, so they're parking on the street. Mm-hmm. Our last can release we tried a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. That probably was a little more problematic for parking. But yeah, you know, I think mainly just we're probably going to need to add or be more easily able to bring another POS system or two out to the we're selling all of our cans in our beer garden area. So. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, it's cool to see a line, but also, you know, if you're in line for 45 minutes or something to get a beer, it's at some point people are going to say, well, I don't know if I want to.
Yeah, you actually bring up a really interesting point about knowing when the restaurant's busy and not trying to compete with that. Mm. And I also see that breweries are dealing with that, whereas their tasting room was a space that was like, literally, if someone paid them $20 to be in there, they'd be like, sure, I'll take $20. I'm not using my tasting room. Like, you know, and or it's a space where you keep pallets of whatever while you're canning or, right? I mean, the tasting room was this kind of no man's land that you would use for everything, and then it'd be open like 10 hours a week. And now a tasting room has the ability to actually make money 40, 50, 60 hours a week. And so that changes the math on, you know, what is a good special event? How much money does a special event have to spend in order to be here? How do we decide when we're willing to be opened and closed for special events? Which is another kind of restaurant thing. Restaurants always have that in mind. Mm-hmm. They know how much money that table would turn otherwise, right? But breweries all of a sudden have these tasting rooms that can make money. And so the question is, you know, all of these other types of special events, I think, have gotten a little more competitive in the market, and breweries are doing really different math on what types of things they allow to have in their tasting room and when.
Frankly, the price has gone up to have your sure. after party same from there. Your wedding at a brewery because, yeah, we went from being open 13 hours a week over 4 days to 35 hours a week over 5 days.
And even when you were open, they weren't big economic drivers.
Right. So now the buyout, you know, you just have to look at the numbers and go, well, yes, we will let you have your wedding party Saturday night at the brewery, but now there's an extra $2,000-3,000 on top of whatever the rental and beer fee might have been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we're open till 11 and we do pretty well Saturday nights.
You're also taking a risk of frustrating some of your customers.
Absolutely.
Who don't get to notice.
Right.
Yeah, because now we have this thing called regulars now. Mm-hmm. People that we do have regulars and they come and they grab six packs to go and it's great. And you can put it out on social and we keep a pretty robust email list and try to do a This Weekend in Wild Heaven email every Wednesday to kind of let everybody know what's happening. But yeah, you're always going to have a few people you piss off, which is part of why that buyout fee is, you know, generous, because I also know I'm probably going to have to say I'm sorry in a tangible way to a few people that show up at the brewery. And I want to make sure that when they get turned away, they're given a little something. You
right,
know?
So there's that goodwill that you're building by being consistently open over time so that you can build that regular relationship. But on top of that, like, you just make good money off of regulars, you know?
I love those
like,
regulars.
The early math that I've looked at coming out of September 1st is that roughly the ratio is 7 to 1. 7 beers through distribution will make you as much money as 1 beer through your tasting room will make you. That if you were to maximize the state law and sell 3,000 barrels of beer through your tap room, in order to make that same amount of money, you would need to sell 21,000 barrels of beer through your wholesaler.
Yeah, I mean, how many brewers are thinking right now, like, what if I just scale back on production and sell it all through here and maximize my retail.
Right. Or if you're a new brewer, how, like, are you thinking, why am I opening with a crazy debt service with this system that is going to put me immediately into distribution in order to maximize it? Why wouldn't I just try to go direct to consumer?
Well, I think there are brewers in planning that are planning on doing just that, where they're they're not going to be a distribution focused, maybe not even at all, type of brewery. They're just going to sell, you know, direct to the consumers through the tap room.
Halfway Crooks is one of them. That's your former brewer, Brian. Sure. He went off to do his own brew, and he's focusing specifically on own premise. My understanding is that's the first one, at least in planning, that anybody knows of that's
read about another one called Sabbath.
Sabbath over in East Atlanta Village.
Right. Yeah, same thing. I think you're going to see a lot more of that.
I would imagine so.
I think it's the breweries that start in the new era that Georgia is in right now with an eye toward brewery-only sales that are going to really build market share that way. I think for those of us who really had to carve out shelf space and get our beers onto tap handles and built market share, significant market share, our barrel size now is significant, and so I think it's harder when you're a destination location like we are, and I imagine you feel the same way, Nick, with where Wild Heaven is in Decatur. Decatur's not right off of a busy highway. It's not easy to get to. You've got to be intentional. It's a great place to come to. It's great restaurants. Breweries are here, but you have to be intentional to come here. And so
I'm a perfect example of that. I end up in Decatur every time I come to Atlanta because there's a density of breweries out here.
Yeah, it's great.
Years from now, when there's a bunch of new breweries that are all on-premise style and they're closer into the heart of Atlanta and they're
Now there are a couple other nooks and crannies around the Atlanta metro where you could do, if not walking, at least very, very short drives and do groups of breweries. But
that becomes more common to think of these breweries integrated into neighborhoods in Atlanta rather than out where the real estate was more attractive for a production facility, the dynamics of that competition for you guys is going to be extremely different than it has been so far. I mean, they're going to benefit from high foot traffic areas. They only need to make a seventh of the beer to make the same amount of money.
But at the same time, like, breweries like that aren't necessarily fighting us as much at like Kroger and Publix for major shelf space. Yes, they are fighting for maybe that Saturday, Sunday afternoon, Friday night share of like who's going out and going up. But I will tell you, it feels to me like more and more people now view visiting a brewery as just a normal and fun, great thing to do. In our tour era in Georgia, I mean, it was popular. I mean, people did that. And there's definitely also a number of people who don't like the fact that they can't go get a decent buzz for $12 at a brewery anymore. That's been actually a little bit of a pushback because we had so many years of 36 ounces, $12. It's a pretty cheap.
That's part of your tour.
That's pretty cheap afternoon or night out, you know, in terms of alcohol. But,
well, I wonder that, you know, as you guys start to adapt and evolve with this new law under your belts to look at retail in a very new way, because it's a new option for you as you start to think about the growth of your company. Why expand another 20,000 barrels if you could sell 3,000 at full retail somewhere, right? Like, you have new options.
But you have to build that, though. I think that's the challenge. It's like, I'm just sitting here thinking, if I took our most popular beer and pulled it out of market and you could only get it here at the brewery, I would immediately have more sales volume out of the tasting room than I've even imagined. Because there's enough people that want that beer that would suddenly be coming to get this beer. But I can't do that. I can't piss off the people that have been buying this beer. They're all over the place. If you start as a brewery only selling beer out of your tasting room, then that's the way people think of you. So they know to get that beer, they've got to travel down to your tasting room.
One of them gets smart and gets an investor and hooks up with a contract brewery and says, well, I've got my retail thing on lockdown. I'm going to get on the shelves at Kroger by doing this thing on contract, and I'm going to eat some of that shelf space, too.
Toppling Goliath has done and it has worked very well for them.
Yeah.
They're a brewery that has totally a destination, totally a brewery people line up for, and yet they've got canned product out there that's running volume for them, and that is contract brewed.
Yep. I mean, there's nothing stopping any of these small guys that are going to benefit from this new law that gives them a retail location and a high traffic foot. That's a great brand-building opportunity for them. They're going to be in the midst of, you know, cool neighborhoods. But they're just starting from a different starting block than you guys are at this point.
But Michael, we're still here in Georgia. We're still here in the Deep South, where we are many years behind the rest of the country, both in advancement of beer culture and density of breweries. So our runway looks different. And I sat down with Bart Watson at the D.C.
Yeah, Bart Watson's the chief economist at the Brewers Association.
Mm-hmm. So, and Nancy was actually there with me when I sat down and I said to Bart, as we were thinking about a second facility, I said, Bart, can you validate an assumption for me? My assumption is, as we see things change around the country, maybe growth rates slowing down a little bit for craft beer, and out in California, I've been told, you know, a lot of breweries for sale, frankly. Mm-hmm. We've heard about, obviously, with Green Flash recently, some scary type stuff, but there's still mostly green arrows out there. I said, but, you know, in the South, we're so far behind, mostly on culture, a little bit on regulatory. Is our runway of good growth a little longer than maybe it is in a Chicago or a San Francisco or a Philadelphia? And he said, not as long as you would think based on the gaps, but yes, there is a longer runway. So like here in Georgia, I don't know what our per capita brewery number.
We still rank 48th in breweries per capita, mm-hmm. right? So if we had the national average of breweries per capita, we'd have an extra 100 breweries here that we don't have. Right. And you know, those 100 breweries are small. They're fewer than 2,000 barrels. Those are the missing breweries.
And those are the ones that we just talked about that are coming. We're the ninth most populous state. Georgia's actually a pretty big state. And for many years, with Atlanta pulling in all these great breweries from around the country and the world, we had actually an unbelievable selection of beers. I mean, Brian and I both got inspired in large part by the same pub you've been to, the Brick Store, and seeing all these great beers from all over the country. It's not that Georgia and Atlanta hasn't been ready and thirsty, and I think all of the results of our businesses show that, but we're still a long way behind. And so I think what that means is in this new environment, there's room for people to try stuff. There's room for new breweries to do new models.
I think there's plenty of room. I guess what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking back to when Chicago decided to start producing rather than just being – we were the most distributed to market in the country. I think we still are. But we weren't necessarily big producers of beer. We didn't have a lot of breweries ourselves. And within a few years, we had 70. I mean, it was just insane how fast it happened. And most of them opened at a time when the culture supported on-premise kind of sales. Like, that became the normal model for a brewery. You don't get breweries that open in Chicago now without a tap room, basically. I mean, that's just like, right. That's an assumption. It's amazing how fast that assumption becomes the new model. And then if you don't have that and you're not part of that culture, you're seen as the previous generation brewer, which loses its relevance and connection to the consumer like that. Sometimes that's culture, sometimes that's logistics and what neighborhoods you're in, whether, you know, are you out in an industrial park or are you in town somewhere? People, like, convenience starts to become a priority for beer drinkers, which before they were willing to go out of their way to do certain things. That's why I've seen around the country that this line culture thing was exciting for a while, and now everybody's trying to solve the line problem because it's holding, you know, more mainstream customers back from even coming to those breweries. They don't want to deal with that kind of complexity in that scene. And so while those things are exciting right now, I think it reminds me of siblings. I'm an oldest in my family. I had two younger brothers. So I think about this metaphor all the time is the first time my younger brother got to like stay out late beyond midnight. I was like, what? Like 6 months ago, I had to come home by midnight. And I was like 17. Like, what are you talking about? And like the rules change and then the dynamics change. And then you either find a way to evolve and take part in that new sort of those new dynamics, or you're kind of left out of it in a way. And I guess I wonder, so to your point, what does that runway really look like? I think in some ways it can be longer in terms of total volume available for local breweries in Georgia to eat up. I think there's tons of that. The pie is huge still. But what does it look like? What does that runway look like in terms of adapting to the new models? That's where
it doesn't mean you've got time to sit on your laurels.
Not at all.
No, I mean you. I think everybody is feeling the need to be creative, to reinvent. I mean, if you're thinking you got it licked, I mean that's probably not a good place to be. You know.
And I know. And today was your first Sunday hours here at Three Caverns,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So like that. I mean, that's how nascent this still is. Is we're still experimenting with like days of the week and
right.
Which hours
yes, we are.
Make sense, even as we're talking about the bigger sort of broad strokes of it.
And I think you'll have more breweries looking at second locations
yeah.
as a brand building opportunity mm-hmm. rather than and going backwards to the way a lot of states do, where you start with an on premise only brewery with a small system, and then you eventually, or maybe you contract brew, or maybe you build your bigger facility out in an industrial park, so now you can start doing distribution, fight for shelf space, where here we have that facility already.
Yeah.
And so what I would be looking for would be a smaller location that we would call the Three Taverns Imaginarium, where all...
So you already know the name of it. You're acting like this is theoretical. And you just told us the name.
There's actually blueprints over in the corner.
Hypothetically,
I was going to call you out just on your smile in the beginning.
I was on the phone with Jordan before he let you guys in here. Get rid of those papers. Move them.
But it's true. I think it's hilarious that what's a brand builder for you is getting a potentially small retail location somewhere. Mm-hmm. What's a brand builder for these new breweries coming up is going to be contracting at a larger scale probably to get on some shelves at Kroger, because those things point to each other.
Right.
And that's important to have both ends of that spectrum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a weird flip.
That is. I hadn't thought of it from the other side, but yeah.
We're all selfish, that's why. We're all just worried about our own.
Yes, a human problem.
GPH is underwritten in part by Brewery Omegang out of Cooperstown, New York, a 20-year-old pioneer of Belgian brewing in America and home to the notorious outdoor festival Belgium Comes to Cooperstown, which returns on August 3rd and 4th this year and features Belgian and Belgian-inspired breweries from around the world. GBH will be there this year leading a series of discussions on the state of Belgian beer, what it means to the people who make and drink it, and what it is about Belgian beer that seems to continuously inspire generations of brewers in the U.S. and around the world. You can still get tickets at omegang.com. GBH is also underwritten in part by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. With New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and sour ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in the early foundational chapters. These are stories about how those beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with for our Coming to America series. Guinness began brewing and never stopped at St. James Gate in Dublin in 1759, and has been shipping beer to America since 1817. Recently, they celebrated their distribution to the U.S. with their 200th anniversary export stout. Coming to America stories highlight the iconic and upstart international brands that are making their way in America in the age of local. And of course, we're also supported by The Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters, such as Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pier Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The Five Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, and Boundary Brewing out of Belfast. In the U.S., we have the Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Common House Ale Works in South Carolina, Ecusta Brewing in North Carolina. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, all supporting us through their monthly ProTier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew.
Let's talk about self-distribution, because I think that's something that is going to be equally generational in its appeal to some folks. Self-distribution not being allowed in Georgia currently. Everybody's going, you know, you're going to have some people that are going to skip it now because it's not valuable to their business plan potentially. They're going to be on-premise only for the most part. But for folks that want to do that and are probably going to, it's probably going to be a priority in the potential for future legislation. How does that sit with brewers like yourselves who are already in distribution franchise contracts, which are pretty strict in the state of Georgia? Why would that ever become something that you would support?
I'd be a hypocrite to not support it. I mean, my view with regards to the brewing business from day one has been, we don't want special treatment. We're not asking for anything that's unusual. We just want the freedom to make our product and sell it, which is why, you know, selling it in our tap rooms is always... For me, and I told our wholesaler years before that law passed, I said, I just want you to know when this starts coming down the pike, I will be loudly supporting this and I will be very behind it. It's not because you're not valuable and amazing and actually critical to the growth of our business. We couldn't do it without you. I said, but if somebody walks into the building where we physically make this product with love and care and passion, I need to be able to take that person's money. That's just, I'm sorry, I'm that American about it. So for me, it'd be difficult to look at some new brewery coming along and say, I don't want you to have this privilege that I frankly thought I should have had all along. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a little upside down at the moment where I can't go back and take advantage of that, I'd have to literally make my wholesaler give up valuable territory, which I don't see any scenario in which that happens, or in which that's even a politically productive conversation for me to have with my wholesaler. So too late for me, I guess, but I'd have a hard time.
Yeah. I also think it's going to be better because for us, the breweries that have already been in distribution, it doesn't clog up the portfolio of the distributor.
That's a great point.
It's where now suddenly we've got 5, 6, 7, 8 new brands in our distributor's portfolio local that he's having to service as well versus let them prove themselves out in the marketplace. And I think you're going to see over time distributors get behind this because do they really want...
That's a bold statement.
Do they really want to take on
it's risk another mitigation 15, for them.
20 new yeah. small breweries and prove those brands in the marketplace? Really? Or would they rather get to the point where let's take the brands that have already proven themselves that we know are viable brands that we can really
hustle. I think that's an exceptionally logical way to think about it. Unless you're a wholesaler in Georgia,
okay. Right. That makes total sense. You're right.
It makes way too much sense, right?
I think there would be some distributors that would be for that. Yeah. But you're right. It might be a small exception.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's my job, hypothetically. It would be my job to do this, and I think Brian's right. I think that there are enough wholesalers that think commonsensically enough about it to say it doesn't make sense for me to drive my minivan to Blue Ridge, Georgia to pick up 4 kegs, to drive them back to Norcross, to spin them around in a warehouse, to drive them back up to Blue Ridge because that's where the consumer base is. Like, it's just not financially... It doesn't make sense for them in the short term. It doesn't make sense for them in the long term. Ultimately, having brands that prove themselves in the marketplace is going to be the thing that makes the most sense for them. Now, the degree to which that attitude and that common sense kind of look at it, it ultimately makes it through the political system, I still think that, you know, we've got a good enough relationships that we can say, here's what makes sense for you, here's what makes sense for us. And let's realistically look at how this works best. And we've seen that in the farm wine industry in Georgia already.
Tell me
farm
more
wine
about
industry
that.
Does have self-distribution up to 25,000 gallons is how they do it. And it's only if a wholesaler, and I don't want to misspeak here, but I think it's you have to go to 3 wholesalers. You have to offer them your product. And if 3 wholesalers say no, then you can self-distribute.
Hmm.
And we have cideries in Atlanta that are doing that right now. Because they're considered wineries in Georgia. So we have cideries that are a block away from one of our breweries, and the cidery is self-distributing to retailers in Atlanta. The brewery cannot. And I'm pretty sure there's no wholesaler anywhere kicking themselves going, like, I really wish I was driving that keg of cider from one place to another. And certainly the consumer and the retailer don't care
mm-hmm.
where it comes from as long as they get it. So I think that there's definitely a path to say, you know, if a brand is kind of X size or this version of small, it makes sense for a little bit of self-distribution. It makes sense. I think for breweries that are established, what it is increased customer service to an account who runs out on a Friday or a festival or a charitable event.
Quality
or that
control,
kind of
frankly.
Thing.
I mean, you were talking earlier
right. It's just easier.
About these beers sitting on the shelves at Kroger a month old. That doesn't happen when it's self-distributed.
Right, I think
much.
That's what self-distribution does for the breweries that are established. Yeah. It's just better customer service for the retailer in certain circumstances. For a brewery that's brand new, it's a chance for them to prove themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And also to take out some of those weeks where I anticipate that we will have breweries that make excellent beer for their tasting room, and the minute they package or put it in keg or it lasts more than 3 weeks or 4 weeks, they'll discover that they're not as good at making beer as they thought that they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that self-distribution phase is an excellent time to learn those lessons.
I would imagine a distributor should agree with that. Now, what I hear in between those lines a little bit is that there's probably a limit at which a wholesaler would want a law mandating that they get an option to carry that product beyond a certain amount. They wouldn't want there to be this sort of like...
Never-ending.
Yeah, this never-ending ability to self-distribute.
The single biggest challenge that the craft brewing industry has in Georgia politically is the fact that there is an Anheuser-Busch facility and 2 MillerCoors facilities that are owned in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia is the 4th largest manufacturer of beer in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We are the 17th largest manufacturer of craft beer. That's our problem. There is nothing that we want that Anheuser-Busch does not also want. And they employ a lot of people. And they employ a lot of people in very important districts. And so does MillerCoors. And by the way, MillerCoors is owned by ABI. So there's no doubt that that's our biggest challenge. The most common sense way of dealing with these problems is to say that a small brewer and a macro brewer are two different styles of businesses, and we should treat them different from a regulatory or legal perspective.
But it sounds like you were saying that there's actually some interests that are aligned there.
There are a few interests. We're all brewers.
Sure.
Right? And I'm speaking pure politics here. Mm-hmm. So kind of how we feel about those companies emotionally and what they do is different.
I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, that there's actually things that the craft brewers want that the macro brewers also want in the state.
Right. But if the macro brewers get them, then the wholesalers fight.
I see.
So if we got them...
it's a slippery slope scenario for wholesalers in almost every direction is what
exactly.
we're getting at. Yeah.
Self-distribution for us is fine. Self-distribution for Anheuser-Busch is terrifying.
Right.
When you're talking to the people that would potentially have a problem with what we're doing, mm-hmm. right? The most common sense way, the way that you'll see that in states where there are not these large facilities, the laws have advanced quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they don't have this mentality. There's not a lobbyist from Anheuser-Busch at that capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, you know, the most common sense way of dealing with it is to say that if you're smaller than 1 million barrels or whatever it is, then you can do these things. And if you're bigger than 1 million barrels, you can do these things, and that's just two different rules.
So
but that's the hardest thing to get. That's
yeah,
the actual
sense.
Really difficult sell here.
Right, because that slippery slope becomes a cliff pretty quickly for those wholesalers when there's a major facility in that area.
Right.
Now, these days, we have to think about facilities as well as something like Goose Island or a Wicked Weed. Those
or
are
Terrapin.
Now, yeah, or a Terrapin. Those
yeah.
are facilities
yeah, when
now
she
that
said
would
there's two Miller
them.
Facilities, the second one was Terrapin.
exactly. Those are now facilities by which those large corporate brewers would also potentially benefit from laws that allow them to have retail licenses as well.
And that's the big question, right? Is if we were to say you can self-distribute up to 3,000 barrels if you make fewer than 50,000 barrels, can Terrapin self-distribute, or are they MillerCoors? How do you write that law? What if MillerCoors owns 50% of a business, or 20% of a business, or 70% of a business? Or what if it's owned by a venture capital firm who owns 30% of some other business?
Mm-hmm.
It gets really difficult to draw that line between who can do what and who can't do what.
Well, it gets really difficult to craft a law that only benefits small craft brewers.
Yes.
That's increasingly difficult. We see the same thing in Chicago where because we are historically a huge distributed to market, we have places like Ballast Point coming in and open up tap rooms. And they have no relevance to Chicago outside of the fact that Constellation's headquarters happens to be there.
Yeah.
So it makes sense there. It makes sense from like a food and beverage and economic standpoint. It's a great cultural hub. But those are, larger craft brewers. We even saw it with Lagunitas are like rolling out these sort of localized versions that are going in places where the regulatory environment allows that to be a lot easier. Nobody wants to go through a bunch of red tape just for one tap room. But into the earlier conversation we had with things like Drizzly, I would imagine that the likes of ABI and MillerCoors wanting those things to be more interesting, more available to their consumers because they're investing a lot in digital and delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the U.S., ZX Ventures from ABI is heavily invested in delivery services. It's one of their mm-hmm. biggest priorities. They would probably love to see that become more available in the U.S. That seems like a place where, if it was interesting to small craft brewers in Georgia, that would be an alignment. But I would imagine it would be a very cautious alignment. I'm curious as to how you sort out those priorities amongst some of the larger and the smaller breweries that way. What is the process on a day-to-day level for someone like yourself to work out the specifics of those things when those interests align or conflict?
Do
you get in the same room with the lobbyists to hash through that?
Oh, absolutely, right? And so my job is to always look out for the craft brewers, but the question is, how realistic are you about the future, right? And my job is to do whatever they tell me to do, right? So if they tell me we are never getting self-distribution and all we want is to be able to do delivery services, then that's what I go down there and I fight for. But generally my view is that the traditional mandatory use of the three-tier system is going away. Ultimately, we will see different paths to market, whether that's direct-to-consumer shipping, direct-to-consumer delivery, self-distribution, distribution to different types of retail accounts, whatever that is. That, 8 months ago, there was literally one way that Nick got to market, and that was through a wholesaler.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's two ways, through his tap room. And so the question is, can we add more ways? Delivery. Can we add shipping? Can we add how many ways can can a brewery or a brew pub get to market, and how do we expand those? And I think that those are going to continue to expand. So as we look at the three-tier system, which does provide some protections for craft brewers in a lot of ways, how do I balance keeping the protections while expanding the access to market at the same time, knowing that eventually I want craft brewers to be as strong as they possibly can be when some of the protections start to fall away,
right,
and when big companies like Ballast Point or Anheuser-Busch or Goose Island come in and start taking advantage of the things that craft breweries take advantage of.
Right.
And so for me, it's always that balancing act. Am I finding more ways for brewers to make more money while keeping the big guys at bay as long as humanly possible? That's my personal balancing act and trying to anticipate that. But also, I mean, my job is just to do what these guys say is best for them. And so that's always, I think that it's going to continue to be a challenge moving forward, because there's ways in which we're aligned with every part of the industry. When I look at our wholesalers, those are Georgia owned small businesses. And these are Georgia owned family owned small businesses that are in this room too. And we are aligned, knowing that we are, that you can call the owner of your wholesaler, and you can call the owner of your wholesaler, and you can call the owner of your wholesaler, and get them on the phone on a Sunday if you needed to, if you wanted to. That's an amazing relationship. We should protect that and recognize that there's really big bag things out in the world, including Total Wine, including Amazon, including Walmart, including ABI, and those things are really scary. And so when you look at any of the tiers, there are areas where we're aligned, and there's areas where I just want to be protectionist. My job is to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And find ways for these guys to make money that no one else gets to do.
Let's talk about franchise laws a little bit, because I know they're pretty strict in Georgia.
Are you guys really excited to talk about franchise laws?
I am.
Is this the part where you edit out everything we say and none of it actually goes on the internet?
What are the biggest sort of factors in the franchise laws in the state of Georgia? Like, I know that if you wanted to leave a contract, what is it, 5 years or something
like
that?
5 years you can't sell beer in the state, isn't that right?
It's four.
Four?
Yeah.
4 years.
Oh, a mere 4 years.
20% better than I thought.
Right. Also, feel free to disagree with any of the things I just said.
am I correct in understanding it's 4 years that you can't have a beer available for sale? So if a beer is sitting on shelf somewhere in some dark corner that gets discovered at the end of 3 years, you're still 4 years away. Is that
true? This is a technicality that has been tested. There was a winery that pulled out for 4 years, and the wholesaler still had like a case in their warehouse, and actually said, no, we've been selling this wine, and it had to go to an administrative hearing. And I think the winery lost. I think the wholesaler won.
Good Lord.
Wow. Yes, 4 years. On the other hand, I would imagine that the current regulatory environment, particularly with my press relations, it would be very hard for a wholesaler to pull that particular card out.
Where do tap rooms fit into that now? Is that technically a beer for sale in the market? Does anybody in this room know?
You're
that?
Asking a question I've never thought of.
So do you mean for the purposes of...
If anybody here was to want to... end of their contract.
Oh, can we kind of drop back to a taproom only, own premise only business for four years in order to get out
and
of a contract?
And then slingshot back into market as a self-distributing brewery.
How many barrels do you all produce right now?
Everybody's eyes are open right now. How many barrels do you produce right now?
We're around 10,000.
Around 10,000. All right. What about yourself?
As a brew pub, I think we're around 800 to 1,000 right now.
Okay. What about yourself?
Six to seven range.
That wouldn't be that hard to pull
back.
Well,
you can only sell 3,000 on site.
What's that?
You can only sell 3,000 on site.
Right, but if it's the same economics, 1/7 of the beer for the same amount of money, pull back to own premise only sales for a while for 4 years, and then slingshot back into the market as a self-distributing brewery.
You would have to have a hell of a relationship with your wholesaler in order to pull that.
Just wargaming here a little bit. I'm just running some numbers in my head for a minute.
I think what's
four
important.
4 years goes by like that.
Yeah, I think what's important to know
making,
that
you have to be making big assumption that's going to work. You're going to max capacity out of your tasting room.
And then
10,000 barrels, right. I only need to sell, 1,500?
Right, or even, but even that another wholesaler would take you if you were to pull that stunt.
Brian's got gray matter, pouring out of his ears right now. I think I know of a brewery in Georgia that, if not trying to do that just to change wholesalers, I think is more or less doing that. I won't say who they are, but I think there are breweries that have thought about, can I make this work better by focusing on that high margin business?
Well, there was one, I'll never remember their name. It was like, you know, Two Peaks or something out in Colorado that pulled out of like six or seven states and went brewpub style with a secondary tap room, and like they just decided they were going to be an on-premise model because they saw the future coming and they couldn't compete for shelves anymore. Mm. More and more people are pulling back into more formidable defensible territory, whether it's your distribution footprint or on-premise at this point, which can certainly be a dramatic strategic tool if you choose to use it that way. But it's interesting. My question, I guess, still remains is, would taproom sales be considered for sale in the market and not allow you to break that contract? I don't know.
Since they're not going through the wholesaler.
I guess it's distribution through a wholesaler, right. I guess. But I don't know that for sure.
Right, yeah.
I mean, lobby to get that down to 2.5 or 3 years and...
Oh, God forbid, right? Anytime we challenge things like that, the wholesalers get a little terrified.
I bet. Well, they probably know that there's a plan behind it.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. What are some of the priorities right now for you legislatively?
Well, I think we're gonna have to go back to the drawing board and see. I think that, we got through this legislative session, which was a little bit of a laid-back session for us. A lot of defense, a lot of just kind of throwing our opinion in the hat here or there. A couple of things that we wanted to have happen that I knew would be more likely to happen if I stayed out of it as opposed to if I got involved. So this session we got brunch bill came through.
That's
so
right.
So brew pubs and breweries will be able to serve alcohol an hour and a half earlier after a local referendum. And on Sundays, isn't that just so exciting, guys? It's not as much extra money as I made you last session, but this session's a little bit. And so there's a few things like that. There was a commercial truck issue in Fulton County. We've seen a few of those types of things come up. The driving of commercial trucks in residential or more populous urban areas and requiring of permits thereof and timing and things like that, which makes beer delivery difficult. There's little things like that that happened this year, although it seemed that more or less ended up being the social director at the Capitol. I was like, it's the cruise director down there.
Well, one of the things I'm increasingly becoming aware of in my own sort of outside looking in status, of course, is it's not just about the priorities that you're setting for the things that you want. It's about reacting to things that show up unexpectedly that have an impact potentially on the brewers that you represent.
I mean, I think that that's exactly it, right? I mean, there's some things with the last law that we could look at. We could say, should we raise the limit? Should we talk about the transfer of product between commonly owned facilities? Should we look at, changing some of the limits that brew pubs are subjected to? These are smaller issues where we're just kind of tweaking what we have. There's big issues like self-distribution and franchise law reform. There's a question of whether or not those have to happen literally at the same time in order to make them make sense.
Mm-hmm. Interesting one, especially for the folks in this room who are thinking about second facilities, being able to send your beer over there versus having to make it there.
Yeah. There's federal law that would make it seem like that shouldn't be an issue, but the state law is a little bit vague and it hasn't really...
Transfer of product is fine. The selling of the transferred product's the question mark.
Right.
And so there's some spaces like that that are interesting, but I also think that you're 100% right. You know, someone might bring franchise law reform before we do.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might bring... this, retail direct sales thing and how hard do we fight to say we want to be on that or we don't want to be on that.
Or the way in which taps get moved around. I mean, we saw it happen in Texas. Yeah. The bill got changed multiple times and a lot of craft brewers are not satisfied or happy with the way that went down. We saw what happened in Maryland when Guinness lobbied for a carve out of their own facility because they wanted it to be a big tourist destination and they sort of got it. But then a bunch of craft brewers cried foul because, of course, that would have fit on their agenda as well, but they didn't necessarily have a voice in time for that to happen. And now it's going back and forth and things are getting kind of screwy. And so it's this like reactive state that you have to be in.
Right. I mean, if I was Jeff Bezos, I would look at the 3-tier system and go, what? Right. Or honestly, if I'm FedEx and I'm UPS, I go, what's the difference between me and a wholesaler?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's...
Well, I've often joked that the United States Postal Service is the biggest distributor of beer in America right now. They're not fully acknowledged.
They're unacknowledged, right? So I think that there's a lot of big interest out there that are going to have agendas and might show up with plans that, You know, I saw the Walmart lobbyist at the state capitol more than I've ever seen him there this last year.
Interesting.
I'm very interested in what he's up to, you know? So there's a lot of interests that are not our interests, and we have to not only know what we want, but we have to be able to prioritize how to react to other things because we have limited political capital.
Yeah.
And who are our allies and what's our coalition and what's the best we can do with the hand that we're dealt, because we're not always, it's not always clean when we come to the legislature about what's going to happen next.
Let's go around the table, and I want to hear sort of what the biggest change in your business has been so far as a result of this the September law, and going forward, what how you think that shifts your priorities. Let's start with you, Nick.
You know, as far as special releases go, we've been more focused on, you know, barrel aged, like fruited sours, bread beers, different things like that. And I think what's really exciting for my partner, Eric, is that we now have a business justification for him to be as creative as he can possibly be, because whereas in the past, I didn't really have a way to make sense of a really small, unique batch of beer. Now we do. And those beers will never be the driver of our volume, but they do drive really nice margin, obviously, and provide a good halo for the rest of the portfolio. And so I think one of the beautiful things is that our brewer gets to be more of who he's supposed to be. And I think that's exciting and energizing, because obviously as a distributing brewery, you get into making the donuts a bit. And brewers, I think, are, at least in the case of our brewer, he's got a deep artistic urge. And I think it's really important and good that we give him an opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
So now there's a model for it.
What about you, Bob?
Yeah, as a brew pub, I think the laws changed, 5 years ago or so, to allow the limits up to 10,000 total production and 5,000 distributed. Us, and I think there's no other breweries in the state, brew pubs in the state, that are even anywhere close to that, probably about a fourth of those levels. So, you know, but as far as what changed over the last couple of years, you know, we were allowed to, at the local level, the decision was put down at the local level to allow us to sell growlers to go. And that was exciting back in 2016. 15, where we were allowed to do that. And, you know, but people don't get as excited about growlers. You know, they want to come and get a 4-pack of cans or, you know, 6-pack of cans or whatever. And so for us, you know, the change that happened in September 1st was, you know, brew pubs, it had been written in state law that they could only sell beer in draft form. And so, you know, with the law changing, allowed us to say, all right, we can sell cans now. And so now we're you know, we don't have, I think most brew pubs are probably going to be in a position where we can't keep up with the because like I said, we sold out of all our cans and, you know, most all of them in roughly an hour. We're putting in some more infrastructure, some more tanks. You know, we won't be able to put I think it wouldn't be wise for us to put a canning line in, but maybe something to streamline things a little bit more so we can get more cans on a, you know, maybe not so much, you know, once or 2 or 3 weeks, but have them available most of the time. So that and, you know, point of sale systems are always, I think we heard that, you know, a few times during this conversation, that's, you know, something we have to figure out. We're more the brew pub, more hardwired type system, where most of the breweries that have started doing it are more iPad mobile based. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say based on one of your comments earlier, get a air card so that, you know, when things are going to go down at some point, if your internet, you're based on just what your wireless signal, you know, you don't want to be scratching credit cards during a line of, you know, 800 people out the door.
Have you seen any of your packaged products show up around the country?
Oh yeah. There's a,
that's, you know, got to be new for you.
It's kind of cool. We'll see. You know, somebody made a trade. That's a huge kind of subculture right now, is where people are, you know, buying it. They're taking it. They're shipping it. They're trading for something. And so we'll see stuff show up all over the country. Hey, I just tried this Wrecking Bar beer, and they sent a picture of the can. That's kind of cool to see that.
Yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. What about you, Brian?
The tap room experience and managing the tap room experience.
Yeah, the community aspect of your physical building has always been important to you.
It's always been very important. And to now be able to actually create the experience that we want versus it just being, before, when you were buying tours, basically, and getting free samples, up to 36 ounces of beer we could pour when you came to visit the brewery. So people will treat it, and still do a lot right now because the culture's catching up, but treated a brewery visit like an event, a special event. I remember when I went to Negril, Jamaica years ago, and they have there's this cafe there. It's called Rick's Cafe, and it sits up on this cliff. And during the day, when you go, people go to this cafe to drink and watch the sunset. It's one of the most spectacular sunsets in the world. And so I was up there, and there's reggae music playing, and there's a cliff that people are diving off of, and there's just all this activity and life. And then the sun starts to set, and right as the last ray disappears over the ocean, I remember I was sitting down at the end of the bar, I turn around and it's empty. It's like the club only existed for that sunset, and that's the way that the brewery tours, the brewery experiences in Georgia prior to the change in the law were. People would come in and pack it out for those 4 hours you were open as an event that they might do once a year, twice a year, maybe once a quarter, depending on how often they traveled to breweries, but that's what it was. And so you had to manage the tap room as an event. And now we have proper glassware for each beer style that we pour.
I don't care what you were about to say. You just made the old days sound romantic.
You know, there was a certain
Who's going to be the first brewer to do the old beer tour days event?
Oh no, we've seen it. There's already been a throwback.
That happens.
Throwback.
Well, there is something
throwback to
about being in a room full of a lot of people with a lot of energy. Yes. There is something about that, but there's also something missing in that, and that's the experience of enjoying the beer the way that the beer is made to be enjoyed, not in little small pours, but a proper pint or a proper glass in the proper glassware, and to have a staff that's trained to be attentive to that, also trying to teach the staff how to upsell, because now it's an opportunity. If somebody comes up and they order two of our new beer, Rowdy and Proud, well, they need to know they can take a case of that home, right?
A case home.
So that's a big part of it. And then we do have a pilot system. We call it Genesis, and we do have what we call the Imaginarium Project. And now that the law has changed, I've incentivized the brew staff to push out more and more experimental beers. And so typically we'll have 3, 4, 5 just one-off batches available only in the tasting room, and we can sell it, and they get to participate in the revenue a little bit with that. And so,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's a great program that we couldn't have done before and wouldn't have done before. So typically it helps us keep our board more alive, more interesting. And you have to do that, I think, in this new world to keep, to give a reason to come back to your brewery weekend after weekend after weekend. So the taproom experience and still learning, still growing in that.
Brian, Bob, Nick, and especially Nancy, thank you very much for taking the time to walk us through all that and share your experience over the last 6 months. It sounds like it's been a bit of a whirlwind.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, I've got to go buy a case of Rowdy and Proud. Excuse me.
Let's go hang out in a proper tap room.
At Brian's Sunset Cafe on top of the roof.
Let's go watch the sun go down.
It's coming.
On Decatur.
It's coming. One of the most beautiful sunsets right over
here. We can make a hole in the roof.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This past week, we took a break from our normal features and set Brian Roth up to publish a series of Sightlines articles detailing the job creation of brewers, called Will Work for Beer. The series analyzes the job growth numbers out this year, looking at pay scales, how those jobs are created, who's benefiting, and how people balance their passions against their financial realities. It's a worthwhile look at some of the stories we tell ourselves for better and worse when it comes to breweries being job creators. But in general, things are looking up for an industry that sort of thrives on inefficiency. Work like this is made possible because of our underwriters and subscribers. We started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions in our editorial. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion. And you should join. If you'd like to support GBH, visit goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.